start, apparently, were to do that. Pardon me?
2 minutes early.
2 minutes early.
Catching up from yesterday.
All right. I thought, I've been talking about Bonhoeffer the whole time I've been here, and I'll probably continue to do that in different ways and different aspects before I forget it. Those of you who are interested in reading and discussion, this afternoon at 4 o'clock we're going to look at the letter, which is published in the Letters and Papers from Prison, from April 30th, 1944, and those of you who have the book can read that letter, and those following it, as far as you care to get, it's the letter in which he begins to talk about non-religious Christianity. And we're also going to have that mimeograph, so those of you who don't happen to have the book or who don't get a chance to read it, we will have it mimeographed, and we can have that in front of us and look at the text and talk about it. So that's what we're going to do at 4 o'clock today. I'd like to say something today about change and changelessness, because I think that it is an issue that has to do with everything that that Bonhoeffer said and did, and it's a kind of a backdrop against which to understand the business of the two spheres that we talked about yesterday afternoon. It's a backdrop against which to understand his formulation of the categories of the penultimate and the ultimate. It has a lot to do with what Carol was talking about today, about the contrast between spiritual Christianity and materialistic Christianity. It has to do with what Norm Nagel was talking about last night, about the circle. And so it's a great big issue, and it has to do with one's whole perspective on life and the world and God and self and Bible. And what I'd like to do today, and we're getting started a little bit early, so there should be time to do this, we've got till 10 o'clock coffee, is that I would like to present a position on change and changelessness, and I hope that I can do that with some degree of clarity, and then we'll have some time to talk about that a little bit today. And we can feed that back in again on succeeding sessions that we have on Bonhoeffer. So you don't have to buy the position that I'm going to try to lay out, but I hope that I can say it in such a way that at least you know what I'm talking about, and you can at least know whether you want to agree or disagree. So let's begin with a statement by Alfred North Whitehead, who's a British mathematician and philosopher who came to the United States and spent most of his time at Harvard University. And he developed a position in philosophy that has come to be known as process philosophy. And that means that he has a big commitment to process and change and time and movement. And he said that the whole history of Western thought, beginning with the Greeks and through European history to the present time, the whole history of Western thought could be written against the background of the hymn, "Abide with me, fast falls the eventide," where "abide with me" stands for the changeless, abide, and "fast falls the eventide" stands for the changing. And Whitehead said that the whole history of the West is an intermix of change and changelessness. Abide with me, fast falls the eventide. Now, I think that Whitehead was a little bit off in the way in which he talked about it, because Whitehead wanted at all costs to preserve some kind of even balance between change and changelessness. Abide with me, transpose the eventide, changelessness change, and he talked about, or Hartshorne, who was a follower of Whitehead, talked about the dipolarity of God. Two poles to God, both change and changelessness. And so Whitehead wanted to say it's both of those things. Now, I think that Whitehead should have looked a little beyond those first lines and gone to the end of the stanza where it says, O thou who changest not, abide with me. And I think that the history of the West has not been so much a history of the interplay of change and changelessness, but it has been the history of changelessness. O thou who changest not, abide with me. Gradually moving into change. In other words, I think changelessness has been gradually abandoned and change has been gradually embraced. Now that's a kind of a position. I think that religion is, I suppose, by its very nature, something that points men to the changeless. Religion is has a built-in element of changelessness, and maybe one can do that in a number of different ways. I think, for instance, that I'm talking about some very big canvas things here about which I know very little, and I dare to do that at Holden because there are enough people around who know enough about all kinds of things so that I figure I'll be corrected if I say something wrong. But if one begins with the history of mankind, then I suppose there was a time when each individual had to scramble like crazy just to feed himself and maybe his immediate family. And maybe that lasted long, long, long time. But civilization or something, group life began when man was able to, let's say, grow more crops than he needed for his immediate family, for his immediate consumption, and he had some kind of surplus. That made possible enterprises in the human situation other than agriculture, and it made possible, for instance, government. I mean, the king and his people are not farming. They're not raising crops, but they are living off the crops, the surplus crops that other people have raised. So government becomes possible. Armies become possible. Soldiers are not farmers. Soldiers have to eat off the stuff that other people have raised. And also, it becomes possible to have priests. It becomes possible to have religious functionaries of various kinds who also eat the surplus crops, right? So at the very beginnings of the human enterprise, you have government people, you have military people, you have religious people, all with their fingers in the common granary that is surplus from all of the people who are working by the sweat of their brow. And so you have, I think, a kind of built-in automatic military, industrial, religious complex. And it's not strange that there is a built-in tendency for the religious functionary to support both the government and the military organization, because all three have their finger in the same pot and live off of the same surplus that's put there by the people who are out there in the fields raising the crops. Now, it seems to me that what that says is that the religionist, as the military and as the government person, has a stake in the status quo. He's making it. He's getting his belly full, and he doesn't want to rock the boat. There is a natural tendency to keep things as they are, to keep things changeless. So you have the government and the military and the religious all fighting for status quo, all fighting for changelessness. Now, that's one way you can go at it. Another way you can go at it is by saying that man lives originally in nature because he's dependent upon nature, and he's dependent upon the overflow of the Nile and its deposit of silt and the retreat of the Nile so that crops can be planted, and the overflow of the Nile and the silt is deposited again, and there is a rhythm to that nature. He's dependent upon the sun rising and the sun setting and the sun rising again. He's dependent upon the monsoon coming and the monsoon season, and then a dry season and the monsoon comes again. There is a rhythm to nature, and that's what Norm Nagel, if I've got my head at all screwed on right, was talking about last night about the circle. There is kind of built in to nature religion, there is built in a cyclical way of things. Mircea Eliade talks about the myth of the eternal return. And so, since my life is dependent upon the cyclical character of nature, therefore there is a fundamental changelessness about nature. I mean, there's movement, there's the monsoon and the dry spell, there's the sun rising and the sun setting, there's movement, but it always comes back to the same place. And we've got that in one of our hymns, when with the ever-circling years comes round the age of gold. That comes out of Stoicism, which has an age of iron, an age of steel, an age of, what is it, silver, and an age of gold, and it goes around and around and around and around. So there's an elemental, fundamental changelessness. And if that's the way nature is, of course, that's the way God is, too. God is fundamentally changeless. So religion tends to support changelessness also from the viewpoint of the cycle of nature. Or one can go at it another way and say that in the West, at least, the whole Western civilization, I think, can be said to be built fundamentally. There are certainly Islamic and Eastern elements that come in, but fundamentally on the Greek tradition and the Hebrew tradition. And it just so happens that there are many elements, certainly in the Greek tradition. Heraclitus said, you never step into the same river twice. He was a kind of a change man, in a way. But the fundamental element in the Greek tradition is for changelessness. And Plato and Aristotle, the two great people in the classic Greek tradition, were both for changelessness. Plato was the original two-sphere man, if we can use that language now, from, I think most of you have been in on that section from the Ethics where Bonhoeffer talks about thinking in terms of two spheres. Plato was the original two-sphere man in that he said there is time and there is eternity. And eternity is equals defined as timelessness. Time is where we live. Eternity is where God lives. Time is movement and change. God is timelessness and changelessness by definition. Body belongs to time and matter and world. Soul belongs to heaven and God and timelessness and changelessness. That's why in the Greek tradition, the afterlife is always talked about as the immortality of the soul. The body is mortal, the soul is immortal. It doesn't die, it doesn't rise, it simply lives eternally. It is timeless, it is changeless. And death consists, Plato says, in the soul's release from the prison house of the body. The body is time-conditioned, the soul is eternal. The soul is a little hunk of God that is nested in this mortal body. And so death is the release. And that's why Socrates can drink the hemlock, he have a big party for his friends, and he can hack it down and say, so long, gang, here I go. There's a regular countdown, and Socrates at the point of zero is off into heaven and into eternity and into timelessness. That's why the resurrection is such an offense when Christianity comes proclaiming that, because the resurrection is something that we wait for. And Bill Layman talked, some of you heard the other night, about sleep. And death is sleep in the Bible. That's waiting for resurrection. That's a time kind of thing. But Plato says God equals eternity equals timelessness. Now, Aristotle is a very different kind of cat, and he has a whole different way of talking from Plato, in that he does not distinguish as sharply between that which is real in eternity and that which is simply a shadow of reality down here in the material temporal world. Aristotle, in a sense, is all for time. And his major categories are potentiality and actuality. Everything in the universe is actualizing its potential. The acorn is becoming an oak tree. The baby is becoming an adult. Huh? The baby squirrel is becoming a big squirrel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everything is moving from its potential to its actuality. And Aristotle says everything is moving. That's very different from Plato. But Aristotle says God is pure act. Now, that's very confusing, because it sounds as though God is pure activity. God is pure action. Aristotle means the exact opposite. God is pure act in that he is purely, totally actualized. There is no potential in God. He is the only place in the whole universe where the movement is not from potentiality to actuality, because God has no potential in him. He is pure act. That means he's stationary. And so Aristotle says he is the great mover. Everything is moving toward him. He's the great mover unmoved. The prime mover unmoved. He is the great unmoved mover. So that Plato and Aristotle, although they talk very, very different kinds of language, wind up at the same place. There is one thing in the universe that does not move, that doesn't change, and that is God. So, I think that you can come at it in a number of different ways, and you can come at it through that cultural anthropology business, the religious, industrial, military complex. You can do it through the nature religions. You can do it philosophically. But to the extent that Christianity has been a religion, and to the extent that Christianity has adapted religious elements into the faith, the church has thought of it as its primary task to tell people who are living in change that there is a way of getting into the realm of the changeless. In this world of change and decay, there is a way into a realm where you don't have to worry about that. You can tie in through prayer, through Bible, through worship. You can tie in with him who is changeless, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and who will never change, God. And that's what that's our business. That is our primary business. We are in the changelessness business, the church has said. We are a place to which you can come buffeted by the winds of change and the sands of change. We are a place to which you can come to escape change. Now, I think that the church has said that, and the church is still saying that. But the problem is that we haven't read the Bible enough. The problem is that we've allowed our message to be taken unconsciously from the beginnings of religiosity, from nature myths, from Greek philosophical tradition. We haven't done enough reading of the Bible, because when you read the scripture, it seems to me, what you have is a story of God and his people, and the whole business is set in a time sequence. Those books of the Bible are slopped together. They were written in many different places and times by many different people, but they're slopped together in a roughly chronological way that tell a story that begins at the beginning and it winds up at the end. And in the meanwhile, it talks about God, who is not by any means changeless, but in the Old Testament, it says over and over again, God repented. He says, all right, you Israelites, you shape up now, or I'm going to blast the living daylights out of you. They shape up, and it says, and God repented. Over and over again in the Old Testament, to repent is to change one's mind. God says, okay, all right, you shaped up, I changed my mind, I won't blast the daylights out of you. Huh? He repents, he changes his mind. He calls Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He does things. He becomes incarnate in Jesus Christ. He pours out his Holy Spirit, and the story goes on. And the categories in the scripture are the old and the new, promise and fulfillment, not up and down or changing and changeless. If you've read Amos, or Jeremiah, or Micah, or if you've come in contact with John the Baptist, or Jesus, or the author of the book of Revelation, you know that those birds are not thumping for the status quo. They are pounding the stump for change. Now, the position that I would like to present to you for your consideration is that almost in spite of itself, the church has gotten out the gospel. In spite of the fact that it has so often been religious instead of Christian, in spite of the fact that its whole orientation has been to changelessness instead of to the living God, the church has nevertheless read the scriptures, and it has preached the good news. That's a time word too, something has happened. And the word, often in spite of the church, has gotten out. People have heard that. People have caught on, sometimes in spite of themselves, sometimes unconsciously, sometimes without ever confessing the name of Christ. Somehow that message has penetrated the soil of Western culture and has brought about a total revolution in human history. You know, it's a big canvas that I'm painting on today. We can argue about this. Has brought about a revelation in human history, and the only time in which this has happened is in the contemporary West. We are living now in the first time and the first place in human history when men have begun to orientate their lives, when men have begun to read the world in times of change, in terms of change rather than in terms of changelessness. Now let me try to spell that out a little bit. I hope you're with me so far. Let me give you a quotation from Leslie Newbegin, who is an Anglican. He was Bishop of the Church of South India. He was in on the formation of the Church of South India, and was in Geneva for a number of years working for World Council of Churches. Now he's back in Madras, India. And he is quoted in a book by a fellow by the name of Aaron van Leuven, a book, Christianity and World History. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of that book or not, but at St. Olaf College, they have what they call a global semester, And everybody who's got about $5,000 sitting around loose goes on this global semester, and they spend 6 months touring the world and spending a month at each of 6 different universities around the world and studying. And when a friend of mine, Oliver Olson, led this global semester, the text for the whole thing was Christianity and World History by Aaron van Leeuwen. That's neither here nor there, but this quotation is from that book. And I happen to like the book, and I happen to like what he has to say. And this is Leslie Newbegin speaking. What is happening now is that the peoples who have no history are being drawn into the history of which the center is Jesus Christ, and that is the only history. Now, obviously, everybody has a history, in a sense. What he's talking about is self-conscious history, that is, self-conscious commitment to time sequence. In other words, that which has been static, or at least cyclical, in which the only movement was round and round, life and death, rise and fall. We heard that said in all kinds of beautiful ways last night from Norm. That is being drawn into a movement which is linear and dynamic, which is moving irreversibly and can never be back where it was before. The ferment of change which arises from the impact upon ancient cultures of the gospel, or at least of that kind of life which has its origin within Christendom, is the force which is giving an irreversible direction to that which was static or merely cyclical. When I say the impact of the gospel or that kind of life which has its origin within Christendom, I include technology, Western political ideas, communism. See? These are all bastard offsprings of the gospel. They don't equal the gospel, but they're bastard offsprings of the gospel. Technology, Western political ideas, communism, all those things which have come into the Eastern world from the West and have their roots in the Christian tradition. Now that's Leslie Newbegin. I'll give you another quote from Paul Tillich. I guess I won't give you that quote from Paul Tillich. Tillich talks about ways of reading the world which are tied to space, changelessness, static, and ways of reading the world which are tied to time, change, movement, process, direction. And he spells those out, and he says, of course, there are all kinds of mixes. There's no time without space, no space without time, etc. But the fundamental orientation is radically different, and the choice is for or against Christianity. See? If you choose space, static, that's against the living God and the risen Christ and the moving Spirit. You choose time, then you're for that, even though maybe you don't know it. Okay, now, I happen to agree with that. I happen to think that the gospel has gotten preached, and that in the modern West, that orientation toward life, which seeks for changelessness in spite of change, has gradually died. The medieval cathedral has collapsed, and it has been replaced by a way of reading the world, a way of reading reality, which is tied to time and change and movement and process and direction. Now let me give you some illustrations of that. I think one can do it in all kinds of ways, but let's do it a little bit extensively in relation to the meaning of words, and then maybe a little bit briefly in relation to some other areas. If you were asked by Random House or Macmillan or somebody to put out a new dictionary, obviously one thing you could do is to get 10 other dictionaries and just collate them, you know. And if you've ever been a student, you know how to do that. You take a piece from here and a piece from there, and you paste scissors and paste them together, and you hand it in. That's possible that you could do it that way. But let's say that you're a man of integrity, and you want to do the job that the publisher is paying you to do. Well, then you have to ask the question, how do I go about that? How do I go about determining what the meaning of a word is. There are two major routes that you can take. One route is the etymological route. Etymology means that you look at the root of the word and you say this English word comes from this Greek word and this Greek word means so-and-so, therefore the English word means so-and-so. Or you say this English word comes from this French word which means so-and-so and therefore that's what the English word means. That's etymology. That's the etymological principle of lexicography or writing dictionaries. There's another route that you can take, and that is the contextual route, and this, well, I've been talking about contextual ethics, which is not just ethics, but which is a way of reading the world. You can go that route which says the meaning of a word is simply the way in which that word happens to be used at a given time and a given place. That the principle of meaning is not etymology, the historical root, but the principle of meaning is usage. How is the word used? Now, a massive switch has taken place not in the 15th or 16th century, when this whole thing started to really move, or Bonhoeffer says, in the letter we're going to look at of April 30th, he says it began somewhere around the 13th century, give or take 100 years. That whole business in the Renaissance and the Reformation really started going, and you know, and then you have Galileo, and you have a move from a geocentric to a heliocentric universe, and all kinds of wild things taking place then, all of which have to do with the change. The move from changelessness to change. Lexicography is so interesting because it has taken so long for that time thing to soak in this area. As recently as 1934, the second edition of Webster's International Unabridged Dictionary was put out, 1934. And the basic principle on which that second edition of Webster was put out was the principle of etymology. Now, you can check that. That's simply a fact. An interpreted fact, but nevertheless. You can read in the introduction to the second edition of Webster how they went about finding the meaning of words, and it's basically etymology. And if you look in the second edition, you see this comes from this Greek root, this comes from this Latin root, and that's basically what the word means. Now, obviously, they give some attention to usage, but the basic principle is etymology. The third edition of Webster, International Unabridged Dictionary, was put out in 1961. Third edition. Some of you remember back in those days the reviews that came out on the third edition of Webster, and people, all the classicists, Saturday Review, for instance, was full of stuff denouncing the third edition of Webster. The New York Times forbid its editors to use it. Forbid its editors to use the third edition of Webster. They said this is absolutely going to ruin the language. They're going to wreck the thing. Our librarian at Luther Seminary, I remember when that third edition came out, and I asked her about it, and she said, well, they'll never replace the second. We're going to buy it. I mean, we've got a back room back there, you know, down in the basement. We'll have it, you know. For those who want to look at it, it's never replaced the second. It's a catastrophe. It's a total catastrophe. Why? The reason is that the third edition of Webster is based on the contextual principle, the principle of usage, rather than the principle of etymology. And when you read the third edition of Webster, what you find is not so much Latin and Greek roots, although they're there. That's still interesting. Huh? But what you find is quotations from Hemingway, Salinger, Kessler, the Sears Roebuck catalog.
That's right. And you can read in the preface to the third edition of Webster how they actually went about putting that thing out, and here's what they say. In conformity with the principle that a definition to be adequate must be written only after an analysis of usage, the definitions in this edition are based chiefly on examples of usage collected since publication of the preceding edition. Members of the editorial staff began in 1936 a systematic reading of books, magazines, newspapers, pamphlets, catalogs, journals, etc. You see, it's not even a matter of saying we'll go only to the great literary geniuses, because they of course know what words mean. You have to read the Sears Roebuck catalog if you want to know what a word means. And so when you read the third edition, you find this word can mean this, it can mean that, it can mean this. Here's a quotation from so-and-so, and there are 18 words in which you can use this, ways in which you can use this word. Because the meaning of words change. And they change not only from time to time, but from place to place. And so communication becomes really a big job, because you've got to find out where in the world this other person's head is at. You have to find out what that word means to him. And when you say the word, you have to try to make some connection, because words do not have permanent change with meaning. All right? When I was in my first year at the seminary, and I was studying a little Greek, and I was absolutely the smartest person around, because I knew some Greek words. This was in about October, I think, of the first year that I was there. I was in the automobile with my sister-in-law and some other people, and we were driving through some district in Chicago, and she said, boy, this is really where the hoi polloi live. And I said, Catherine, you're a great girl and all that, but hoi polloi comes from the Greek polos, which means many. And so the hoi polloi are not the wealthy and the rich and the, you know, the upper class. The hoi polloi are the masses. And so I'm very sorry, but you know, you're simply wrong about that. And she said, well, I don't know anything about Greek, but I do know that hoi polloi means the upper crust. And so we fought back and forth, and we finally came to a standstill, and I stuck out my tongue at her, and she stuck out her tongue at me, and that was about all we could do with that. When the third edition of Webster came out, let me tell you, first of all, that in the second edition of Webster, hoi polloi equals the masses. That's what it means etymologically. That's simply the correct meaning. Third edition of Webster, hoi polloi means either the masses, everybody, the lower strata, the slobs, or it means the upper crust, the biggies, the learned people, the wealthy. It can mean either one, right? Not because of etymology, but because of usage, you see? So I was wrong, really, and she was right, because she was a third edition Webster person. Some of you know the American Heritage Dictionary. That's recently come out. And maybe you've read some reviews of that, or maybe you've read the principles by which that thing was put out. They had a committee of 100 people. And they sat around like this. They had a fireplace, and they had, you know, they most of them took off their shoes.
Thank you.
Right? And they just sat there, and they went through the words, and they took a vote on what the words meant. That's right. And so in the American Heritage Dictionary, you look up a word, and it says, and they'll tell you who's on the panel, see? And they're not all great literary geniuses, they're people, right? And you can and you look up a word, and it says 37% of the people say it means this, 22% say it means that, 3% of say it means that, and that's, you may not like that, but that's where it's at. That's what reality is about.
words do not have permanent meanings. Cassell's New German Dictionary is a new edition that was put out in, 60 something like this. And the German language, as you know, is a language in which, if there's any language in which you ought to be correct, it's the German language, right? Now, these people say, this is a new edition of Cassell's. Today, many fresh demands are made upon the compiler of a dictionary. It is no longer enough that he should be fully conversant with the present-day standards of the language. He must not merely bring the vocabulary up to date, nor must he confine himself to the definition of a word as such, but he has to take into account its meaning within a given context and its idiomatic variations. This aspect of the language as a living organism, moving, changing, has particularly been borne in mind in the present dictionary, etc. There is a great myth in the German language. I don't see the Falkensteins, and they can, give me the word on this later, because I only know maybe 10% what I'm talking about, and I may be quite wrong, but I'm reading out of Cassell. They say it is characteristic of Germans that an idea pursued long and earnestly enough becomes more real than reality. So it was with the idea that a united Germany ought to have an accepted standard language. Those of you who have studied German know something about Hochdeutsch, right? That's correct German. And if you don't speak Hochdeutsch, then you're speaking a dialect. It says, Prussia, the dominant partner in the political unification, more or less dictated the linguistic criteria. Then it says, nevertheless, what is described as standard German remained an unrealized ideal, or at best the lowest common denominator of the various forms of language used by Germans over the wide language area. In its printed form, to be sure, a superficial standardization was imposed by the Leipzig typographers. However, in Hamburg, Cologne, Stuttgart, Munich, Zurich, Vienna, educated German speakers continue to use language which in vocabulary and phonology is very different from the standard. In Zurich and Vienna and in Munich, to some extent at least, there is even no willingness to acknowledge the validity of the standard. In other words, all this time people have been operating with this myth of Hochdeutsch. There is a correct language, and that's not true. You go around in Germany and they speak all kinds of different languages, and in the new Cassell's, Bavarian, quote, dialect, words and phrases are included on a par with Hochdeutsch Prussian words. Now that is a remarkable switch from a notion of language as essentially changeless to a notion of language as changing. Now I've taken a lot of time with the language thing, and I think that you can do that in any field of the human enterprise, and I'm just going to refer briefly to some other areas. And then we can talk some, okay? Physics, for instance. What is matter? What is stuff? I happened to be a chemistry major in college, and we used to make models of matter, various compounds with Tinker Toy sets. You know, you get sticks and balls together and you say, here's aspirin, you know, and that is just a static kind of combination of things. When I was back in grade school, I learned the law of the conservation of matter. Some of you are in that age bracket. And we learned that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. Later on in high school, I learned, no, we made a slight miscalculation there. Matter can be created and destroyed, but energy, as the law of conservation of energy, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. You see? There has to be something that's changeless, that's static. What's matter, then? Then later in college, I learned something about, at least I learned how to say, the second law of thermodynamics and the law of entropy, which has to do with a running down universe and which has to do with change and movement. And that law of a conservation of matter and energy is no longer quite all that true. What has happened in the switch, and there are probably physicists here who can correct me like the Falkensteins can correct me German, and there are cultural anthropologists that can correct me. You know, I'm really out of my tree here in all kinds of areas that I don't know very much about. But the switch from Newton to Einstein is the switch from organizing matter, understanding matter in terms of changelessness, to a way of understanding matter in terms of change. I'll give you a little quote from Ian Barbour, who is at Carleton College, and he puts this thing in kind of a little nutshell. He says, classically, matter was thought to consist of inert particles that could be arranged in space without themselves undergoing any change. In that system, in that Newtonian system, a particle does not require any temporal duration in order to be. It simply is. You arrange it spatially. In the new physics, Heisenberg, Einstein, Niels Bohr, etc., time is constitutive of the being of atoms. That is, you cannot have matter without time. A wave or a musical note requires time in order to exist. A note is nothing at an instant. Matter seems more like a sequence of events than a collection of substances. Matter seems more like a sequence of events than a collection of substances. Now that is remarkably put, it seems to me. Whereas in Newtonian physics, it's a collection of substances. In the new physics and quantum physics, it is a sequence of events. Norbert Wiener, who is one of the fathers of cybernetics, in a book that, I guess I won't read that quote, it's a little bit long. Let's go to biology. I won't dare talk about geology because Floyd has come in, and I'm sure that you could do the same thing in that field, although maybe geologists never were changeless people. I don't see how they could be, but maybe there was something, maybe there was a period there too. But in biology, certainly Aristotle was the first great biologist, and he saw his task as simply the classifying of forms of plant and animal life that are permanent. The job of the biologist is simply to get some boxes. Liquor store is really the best place to get those because they're, you know, if you've ever moved, they're nice and heavy. And you get lots of them, and you strew them all over the room. And you take all everything that was in Noah's Ark, and you just deal it out, right? You sort it out in the boxes. And then you have phylum and subphylum and class and order, and you have all of these names in big boxes and little boxes, and that's what biology was about. And who was it? Linnaeus, I guess, who was the guy who, the father of modern biological classification. But Darwin and his precursors and followers really shook the church, not because they said that man comes from the apes, but because they said that God's creation is moving. It's not static. And biology then becomes a science by which one not simply classifies permanent forms of plant and animal life, but biology becomes a science in which one understands the development from one thing to another. And change is a constitutive, essential, necessary way of understanding what life, including human life, is about. And the church, which has said God is changeless and surely his chief creation is changeless, was dealt a crushing blow by Freud, by Darwin, who, according to Van Leeuwen and Bonhoeffer and Leslie Newbegin, and I would agree, had picked up his commitment to change from the gospel, maybe without either the church or himself knowing it. So that you can do that in Rome Biology. There is a book by Theodosius Dobzhansky. I practiced long hours in front of a mirror with pebbles in my mouth to learn how to say that name. And the title of the book is The Biology of Ultimate Concern, and it is in a series of books entitled Perspectives in Humanism, edited by Ruth Nanda Anshin. And Ruth Nanda Anshin is the one who writes the preface to this whole series of books. And she apparently is a very busy woman and doesn't read the manuscripts that come to her for the series that she's publishing, because this is what she says in the preface to this book by Dobzhansky. She says, "Perspectives in Humanism," this is the whole series of books, "is designed to affirm that the world, the universe, and man are remarkably stable and elementally unchanging. It is that heritage of timeless and immutable values on which we can fix our gaze whenever the language of change and decline which history speaks seems to become too overwhelming for the human heart." This is her preface to the book. This is what Dobzhansky says in the book. "In any case, the world is not fixed, not finished, and not unchangeable. Everything in it is engaged in evolutionary flow and development. In particular, it is not true that human nature does not change. This nature is not a status, but a process. The potentialities of man's development are far from exhausted, either biologically or culturally." Now, I think you can do that. You can go from Adam Smith to Keynes in economics. I think you can go from Rembrandt to Jackson Pollock or Andy Warhol in art. I think that you can examine any aspect of the modern human enterprise, and you can trace a remarkable and radical shift from space, status, changelessness, to movement, process, change. I think that this has happened in the West because the church, in spite of its religious commitment to changelessness, has nevertheless read the Bible, preached the gospel, and that message of the living God, the risen Christ, the moving Spirit, has, many times in spite of the church, gotten out and has been heard and has penetrated the soil of the West, has impregnated the unconsciousness, the unconscious mind of Western man, and the business of change has happened. I think that is now spreading across the earth in technology, Newbegin says, in communism, in all kinds of different ways of reading reality that are tied to change rather than changelessness. The church, I am afraid, sometimes looks at this and begins to understand what's happening and runs in retreat, runs in fright, and says, "Oh my goodness, everything is changing so fast, so rapidly, and that's a terrible thing that's happened, and we've got to get people back into that medieval cathedral. We've got to get people to realize that the real things in life are changeless and will never change." Bonhoeffer said the opposite. He said, "What has happened is a result, in part at least, of the penetration of the culture by the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that's by no means an unambiguous penetration. There are all kinds of pluses and minuses. It's possible to frustrate as well as to accelerate God's purpose in this world, so by no means unambiguous, but nevertheless, it's in no small part due to the penetration of the gospel. It's something for which to praise God, and it is a great moment in the history of the world. It's a great time in which to be alive, and that it's a great time to read the scriptures in order to get in on some clues as to the kinds of styles, the ways in which the living God acts with his world and redeems his world, and it's a time to get in on what he's doing. Now, that's a kind of that's a position. And that has something to do with the two spheres business. It has something to do with non-religious Christianity. It has something to do with Carroll's materialistic Christianity, with Norm Nagel's talking about resurrection rather than cyclical business last night. I think it stands behind an awful lot of what goes on at Holden. And I just tried to lay that out. And so, what do you think about that? Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, there may be change last night. But from our point of view, it may not be important if there's change in the person. Somebody told me once that a mosquito will live 24 hours. So, whether that's true or not, if he does live 24 hours, you know, the sun goes around once. Okay, to us, you know, the sun goes around and around. It comes up and goes down. The mosquito goes around once. So the sun is always changing, the mosquito. From his point of view, it's not important whether it comes up again. It's important that it goes over once and we'll call it changing, so he has to adapt his life to accommodate that always changing thing. Mm-hmm. And I suppose in our point, if there is some, you know, from a macroscopic point of view, some changelessness, maybe civilization might turn over on this thing, right?
Yeah.
I guess to us living here in this day, that kind of changelessness is not important. I mean, you know, we're living in a time.
For me and for you and all of us, we got to move and see it as a changing thing because we're involved in that change.
I guess that I would want to say that it does make a lot of difference. The Hindus have a great macroscopic view of the universe in which change is allowed for maybe hundreds of millions of years, in which change takes place and in which they can talk about change. But there are, in the great grand picture of reality, cycles. And maybe it takes billions of years to come around to the same point, but it will come around to that same point again, and the whole business will start over again, and it has in the past, and it will again. And that cyclical view of history says, in Hinduism, that change in time and process may be of some importance, but it is not of ultimate importance. It matters, but it doesn't really matter. And from that you get reincarnation, you get a negative view of the body because it's the soul that inhabits, you know, new bodies over and over again. The body doesn't really matter. We had on our doorstep one time in Madras a couple of guys that had been brought by someone 200 miles overland. They were both dying of cancer. And he brought him in to ask us to bring them to the hospital. We said, yes, we'll bring you to the hospital and we'll try our best to get you in there today. They said, could we have bus fare to go home? There was no way that we could get those guys into the hospital. They were not the slightest bit interested in being healed. And, you know, they didn't think that out rationally. But in their bloodstream was the notion that let's get rid of this body and get a new one, for goodness sakes. So finally we gave them bus fare and home they went to die. There is an attitude toward life, toward body, toward the earth, I think, that develops even when that cycle is, you know, billions of years long. So I guess I would want to say, we can argue this. I think it's an arguable point, certainly. But I would want to say it does make a difference. Whether one considers there to really be a beginning and really an end, or whether one considers the thing to be going around and around.
Where does Taylor come in here?
Well, I think that there are many people who are saying this type of thing, and he's one of them. Some of you know that name of Teilhard, I don't know what the correct pronunciation is, Teilhard de Chardin, who was a French Jesuit priest. He was a paleontologist by trade. He was also a Jesuit priest. And he, at a very early age, was very convinced of the evolutionary character of the universe. And he wound up building up a whole theology, a whole philosophy, a whole way of reading the world in evolutionary terms, in which God and man and the world were all in process. And the Jesuits would not allow any of that stuff to be published, and it was only after his death in New York City he died. He always wanted through his life to die on Easter morning, on the Festival of the Resurrection, and he pulled that off somehow, and died on Easter morning in New York City, and his family got that stuff together, and it's been published since. But Teilhard is one of many people today, I mean, he's dead now, huh? But recently, who have tried to work out a scheme of things based on time rather than space, based on change rather than changelessness. So I think Teilhard fits in very, very well. That doesn't mean by any means that there is no difference between, for instance, Teilhard and Bonhoeffer. I think there are remarkable differences. But basically, he's committed to that change thing.
Doesn't the word recall God creator, doesn't that mean one who is creating? And what is creating
mean? Yeah, great. If you are into the time thing, it means that. But if you were a Newtonian, if you lived in the 18th century, then creator would not mean to you, I mean, I know that it, I shouldn't say that, because if you lived in the 18th century, you'd be way ahead of, you know, the pack, and you would be thinking this way. But let's say someone else living in the 18th century. Yeah. Be a Newtonian, then God the Creator would mean that he created, huh? Somehow or another, he got the thing going, but he's not creating, huh? He created it out of nothing, but he's not continually creating. And so then you have what Bonhoeffer calls in these letters, we'll look at one of them this afternoon, the Deus Ex Machina, the God of the machine, the watchmaker who made the watch beautifully, huh? Every little wheel just right, wound it up, and then he doesn't have to do anything with it because the watch runs on its own. And that was the theological counterpart of Newtonian physics, which was committed essentially to changelessness rather than change. If you're into the change and time thing, then what you do is start reading all of the nouns as though they were verbs, as you did. God creator, that means God is creating. Huh? And, pardon me? That's right, right. But I think it's very, very important to know and to say and to understand that there were centuries in which people said he could stop, said very specifically that he could stop, and that he did stop, and that God is by definition changeless, even though somehow or another way back there he made the watch and wound it up. See? God is love. What does that mean? If you're into space, that means God is in a different realm. We live in a realm of hate, but God is in the other sphere of love. But if you're into the time thing, then you say God is love means God loves. Huh? God is a loving God. And all in the Hebrew language, all, maybe that's accident. I don't know. I don't think it's an accident. But there is no such thing as a noun that is independent of a verb. All nouns are essentially verb
forms. All nouns are built from verbs. Nouns are all action words. Huh? That's beautiful that somehow or another the thing happened in such a way that the thing got said in an action language. Huh? Let's. We've got Paul and then Norm.
May Lutheran lay missionary among the Presbyterians address a question?
Only if he's proved himself in the pool hall.
Well, anyway, it seems to me that it disturbs me as a lay Lutheran missionary that everything has to be changing. Mustn't we have an unchanging Bible and an unchanging Augsburg Confession, for example?
I am, if I haven't said it before, I hope that you've smelled it. I am a big Bible pounder, and I will even say things like the Bible is the final authority in all matters of faith and life, and I'll fight anybody on that. The Bible, however, is the final authority. Not because it is you wouldn't say this, but some people would say this, because it is some little hunk of the changeless God that has dropped into a changing world. But it is the final authority because it is the collection of the documents of the primitive Christian community. It is the word of witness of those people who touched and felt and heard and saw, as John says in his first epistle, the word of life. And the Bible can be understood and read only when it is understood and read in the context of time and movement and process. That is, when one pays some attention to that time and that place in which those documents arose, and some attention to this time and this place in which we live, and then struggle, you know, with the connection, because the same God who called Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the God who raised Jesus Christ from the dead and who moves and lives in our time and in our place. So that there is, I suppose, I would rather use words like faithfulness. God is faith. God is not arbitrary. He's not chaotic. He's not fickle. He's faithful to his people. He's faithful to his covenant promises. There is a certain kind of consistency, a certain kind of constancy to God's activity. But I think the changelessness is in light of the whole history, you know, of the emasculation of the Christian faith by religiosity. I think that changelessness is a singularly inappropriate word to use about God or Bible or sacrament or prayer or anything else.
Well, now shall we go on and talk about the Augsburg Confession?
Yes. I would say that the Augsburg Confession is the same kind of deal. For some reason or other, when I was a student at Luther Seminary, through no fault of my teachers, I'm sure, but through my own naivete and bullheadedness, I had the impression that there were two options on the Lutheran confessions. You could either worship them as the final true sentences that dropped from God, or you could shove them aside and say, who cares about the confessions? I worship the living Christ. You had those two options. And it took a long time for it to break through for me that the confessions are what they are, and not something else. The confessions are documents that were cranked out at a specific time and a specific place in a specific context, a specific situation, for a specific purpose, in the light of a specific enemy, and those documents have blood flowing through them, and they have fire in them, and one can only catch that fire, one can only taste that blood by going back to that time and that place in which they came about. And I confess, in the words of the, I happen to be a Lutheran, in the words of the Lutheran Confessions, because I have a continuity with those people. I'm in a different time, in a different place. And that's what Bonhoeffer and the confessing, verb not noun, people said at Barmen. Huh? They didn't, you don't reject the Augsburg Confession, but now is a new time and a new place and a new heresy, and we've got to say it again in a different way for this time and this place. So there is an alternative to either worshiping or fleshing the confessions. The alternative is to understand them historically, temporally, situationally, contextually, and to embrace the God who acted in and spoke through those people and who acts in and speaks through us now.
Well, would it therefore be then a healthy exercise for the Lutheran to now write, struggle through the pain and agony of writing a new confession, particularly applicable to the pains and to the blood of the present day?
That's what they're doing, Paul. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has the
mission affirmation.
Mission affirmation. The Lutheran Church in America has the manifesto. What do you call yours, Jim? Well, anyway, the three bodies are now studying the two to see if they can come up with one.
That's something that would have an official statement a Lutheran, a new Lutheran confession.
Let me say that there are at least two positions on that.
There must be at least two.
Right. Karl Barth said, confession is not something that you do sitting at a desk. Huh?
We did it in the Presbyterian Church.
I know you did. and I know very well that you did. And that's the second position.
Oh, excuse me, I want to interrupt you.
But Barth said you ought not to have done that. Because confession is not theology. It has something to do with theology, but it's not theology. Confession is not something that you do leisurely. Confession is not something that you do, you know, by committee work and coffee breaks and stuff like this. Confession is something that the church does when it's backed up against the wall by Antichrist. See? That's what confession is. And they talked about, the Barmen people, Bard talked about in statu confessionis, when the church is in the state of confession. And that was one of the big arguments during the Nazi years, whether or not the church was, in fact, in statu confessionis. Bonhoeffer, Bard, and those people said, yes, we are now confronted not by some heresy, not by some new time in which we have to say it in a new way. I mean, the church does that all the time, hopefully through preaching and through theology. But we are now in a state of being back up against the wall by Antichrist. We are in a state where we are confronted by apostasy, and now we must, Bonhoeffer said, confess, confess, confess. And so confession happens in those times in history when the church must confess, you know, for its very life. And one could say that we're in that time and place now. But those Bardian people, I think, would say no. The other position is that confession is a kind of a theological statement, and that it is a kind of a summation of the whole faith, you know, that's said in contemporary terms or something like this. Bart would disagree. I would disagree. And if you read the confessions, if you read the creeds, they are never, they're always one-sided. They're always extrapolations from one dominant theme. The Lutheran confessions are not a summary of the whole Christian faith. They are a symphony on the theme, justification by grace alone. There's all kinds of stuff the doctrine of the Trinity, is the confessions say nothing about that. That's all. I mean, in the Formula of Concord, in the Augsburg Confession, the first article is God, and it's about this long. Huh? They say we believe in the Trinity. That was no argument. Then they go on to sin, and that's really something. By the time the Formula of Concord is written, original sin is Article 1. They don't even bother with God. That doesn't mean they don't believe in God. But they're backed up against the wall, and the issue is whether or not a man is saved by grace alone. You don't go to a confession to get a summary of the Christian faith. You go to a confession to taste and to smell and to feel how the church, by the power of the Holy Spirit, confessed the name of Jesus Christ in a moment when it was threatened with death by the Antichrist. Now that's, you know, that's the thing.
Well, in case of Presbyterian, I'm sure that these elements that you have mentioned so vibrantly present, but there were also a few that had their hand in the writing of the Confession of 1967 that may have thought that there were some heresies in the Westminster Confession, for example,
yes,
that needed restating. Is it possible that there could be any such wild elements in the Lutheran Church that might think there were some heresies in,
sure,
the Augsburg Confession that needed a little restating?
The Formula of Concord says talks about the perpetual virginity of Mary, that Mary was forever a virgin. I don't think that's either true or biblical.
Well, we settled that fairly neatly in Presbyterian circles a number of years ago. Our General Assembly took a vote on it by a very close margin to decide whether she was a virgin or not.
See, but I say,
we reverse ourselves.
I say,
it won't be hard on Mary, but it won't be hard on Presbyterians. We live in this.
I say, but leave that in there. That doesn't bother me a bit that that's in there. I don't think you don't rewrite an historical document. It's there, and so it's there. And at Barman the church confessed so-and-so,
Jim, but that's easy. It's easy for you to say.
Oh, how do you know it's easy for me to say?
It sounded easy. Let's put it that way. But when the life of the church is so inextricably linked to that, I mean, you know, what's the church going to do at a convention? For Pete's sake.
In Milwaukee, I know what people do.
Any convention.
You know, if you have a problem on the other side here, though, of intellectual arrogance that's born of a cult of modernity, so we're going to edit these brothers by the 20th century or the 16th, and that's just what a confession is, and what you get is Hebrews. And what you get is something far worse than what you had, really. I think that I have to offer Barstow's position, because you can make the one thing that St. John's for confession from itself is that God works for him, and we might have believed in him through the word and sacrament. Well, that's what right at the present, and you've got that, so you're saved from making an idolatry of the word. If the document saves you from, that's fine. You take what Barth did with the Westminster, with the Scottish Confession, that's one of the delightful things in historical scholarship for his Gifford lecture. Great, he couldn't have done that with your Confession of 1967.
Well, we got around we didn't attempt to refute any of the previous confessions. We have a book of confessions now, just as you have something called a book of Concord. But it bothers me sometimes that you haven't made any recent additions to the book of Concord.
Theology is going on all the time. Preaching is going on all the time. The word is being said in specific times and specific places all the time. Huh? But it seems to me, and like these mission affirmations and all kinds of statements are being passed by boards and committees all the time, it's just a question of whether you want to call all of those things confessions. You know, I think that's very significant that in the Church of Berlin-Brandenburg, you don't have, you know, the 41 essay by Rudolf Bultmann in the front of the hymnal, you know. That's a hunk of theology that is terribly important, significant, etc. You don't have some guy's sermon there that he preached on some Sunday, but you do have, along with the classic confessions and creeds, you do have the Barman Confession of 1934, because that was really a confession. I don't know.